I'm Roger Spotswood, the director of Tomorrow Never Dies, and I'm here with a friend and a colleague from many films, Dan Petrie Jr.
Hi, Roger. Great to be with you.
Good morning.
Roger, when you take on a Bond film, you have to know that every friend that you have in the business, like me, is going to be calling you up with unsolicited advice about making it better, faster, funnier than the previous Bond films, and everybody's got their own way of doing that. How do you deal with that when you have to be the guy making those decisions?
I found I received an enormous amount of advice. People wanted more women in them, better gadgets, faster cars. Everyone has their own point of view. And you quickly discover how much everyone is invested in the series. All over the world, people will give you advice. The moment they hear you're doing the next Bond film, the waiter in the restaurant, anyone will come up and tell you, this is how it should be. This is what we need to do. The last one was great, but this one has to be better, and it has to be better in this particular way. I, of course, also have my own opinions about trying to make it a little bit different and make it a little personal so that I would be more invested in it. And so I tried to assimilate all these different references. I found coming to it, it's quite daunting. The last one I thought it worked terribly well, and we had to try and do it better, try and make it fresh and new, and yet still give people what they essentially wanted from Bond films.
Checking the databases. We've got our first match. Satoshi Isagura, chemical expert, wanted for the Tokyo...
One of the writers of the last one, GoldenEye, was the writer of this one. Bruce Feirstein started the picture and went all the way through, but his first draft involved the fall of Hong Kong, and you had to change that suddenly after you were, well...
I think in October, in fact, 2 months into the film, UA decided that with Hong Kong being handed over in the summer of the next year, right in the middle of our shooting, it was too risky to have a story based so much on Hong Kong. So Bruce had to sit down again and rethink the whole thing and try and come up with a new story, a new premise, and an entirely new script. It was a huge undertaking, which kept him busy for really until the end of shooting, and he did wonderfully. It was enormously difficult to know that a film was being prepared around you, and almost everything had to be changed. This scene here, in fact, is one of the few scenes, this and the Stinky of the Devonshire, which were the same as in his original script. This and the character of Carver, he'd come up with this wonderful character of a villain, and he made it very fresh and smart and funny, and it was what attracted me to the film. That character, of course, was preserved and made even better.
Now, as Bruce was rewriting the script, you had to be in prep on the whole movie. You had to be looking for locations and working out these sequences. How do you manage that?
It's crazy. It's a completely mad world. We found that we'd hired this enormous organization, many of whom had done Bond films before, but many who were new. And you have to put them to work immediately, even if you don't have a script, even if you're busy rewriting it. So, in fact, we picked four scenes. This was one of them. The Sinking of the Devonshire was a second. And then a car chase and a bike chase. We picked four scenes, came up with the car chase and the bike chase, and had them prepare that. Those scenes were essentially written with storyboards and ideas. They were not even on the page. The car chase and the bike chase, I should say, were not on the page. And we created them through storyboards and gave four sequences to the various departments to start work on.
Evacuate your troops and get him out of there now.
White Knight, come in.
But this scene was the one that we already had. This was Bruce's opening scene. It was terrific and has never been changed. It was actually preceded by another small sequence on an ice fall with Bond getting here by climbing a very dangerous ice fall. And it was in a way parallel to the bungee jump in GoldenEye. But for various reasons, we found it was too dangerous to shoot and impossible to really make work without an enormous amount of CGI. And we actually struggled for months to find a replacement, something that would be as good and powerful as the bungee jump in GoldenEye. And in the end found that we didn't really have something that was that good, and we dropped it and we started with the rest of the scene. So this is Bruce, this was the scene that started in the original script.
Now, during this sequence that we're watching, the there's a combination of second unit, first unit, and studio shots, obviously, as we cut back to the MI5 headquarters. How is all of this orchestrated? Do you see these cuts in your head before you start, working with the storyboard artist?
Not before the storyboard artist. I go through the scene with the storyboard artist, with Martin Asbury, who I knew from Air America, and we work out the scene, and he starts sketching things, and it's very much a back-and-forth arrangement. He shows me a draft, and I say, no, could we have another angle of this? We need more here. And you build a story in pictures until it seems to be the right length and be visceral and strong enough. And Vic Armstrong would come and look at them, and the CGI people would come and look at it. We would decide which shots could be done in which way. And eventually it got broken up, and Vic, who did a wonderful job, he did extraordinary shooting here and elsewhere. We found this location in the Pyrenees, and this was all created in the Pyrenees, and then parts of it recreated at Frogmore, just outside London. And all of the work with Pierce was done there, and these wider shots and many of the running shots and an enormous amount of the sequence was actually shot in the Pyrenees.
Now, obviously, that is a huge challenge for coordination to shoot sequences that have to cut with each other in such widely separated physical and climate locations.
Yes, Pierce, we were shooting in the summer in Frogmore outside London, and this obviously was shot in February in the Pyrenees. It's very difficult. I found this was the hardest part of it, to try to conceive of the entire film, to have the smell of it, the pace of it, the style of it in my head, and then have to unify it with so many different units. We had a model unit, we had two aerial units, a halo jump unit and a flying unit and a fixed unit. And to try and keep all of this so that it became a unified film, it didn't feel like a film that was disparate elements linked together, I think that's the hardest part of it.
We see movies over and over again where it kind of leaps out at you that something has been shot at a studio and another shot has been shot in the real location. This doesn't have that feeling at all.
Well, we're lucky. We tried an enormous number of ways of doing things. And actually, some of these shots here, it's interesting, on the pilots and on Pierce, are shot in Frogmore with just a painted backdrop, which is being rotated behind the plane. It's a very primitive old system used really from the beginning of films. And that's combined with CGI work, like the rockets flying after the plane here.
So is the process that you were referring to of painted backdrop and is that what's known as poor man's process?
Very poor man's process, and we weren't in fact that poor, but it still continues to be one of the best processes.
Well, the poor man's process is combined with what you'd call the rich man's process.
Yes.
In some of these shots.
Liberally, yes. So there's a lot of CGI work, shots that have been enhanced afterwards or combined together. That's one of them, where the plane goes, the seat goes into the other plane. But it's a mixture of poor and very rich processes.
I remember when I first read the script and the line, backseat driver, I just howled. I thought it was hysterical.
It's very good. Bruce came up with a lot of terrific one-liners. I hoped that the film would have as much or more humor than previous films, and he certainly managed to deliver that.
Well, you did get more humor than some of the previous films have had. What other things were you going for that you wanted to keep from previous films? And maybe the next question is, what did you want to change from previous films?
Well, I thought with the character Bruce had written of Carver, we had a very interesting villain who was perhaps a little bit more realistic than previous Bond villains, some of whom were really wonderful, but I thought this was an interesting way to start a small change. And Carver and his media link was such an interesting character that it allowed us to make the film slightly more realistic than some of the earlier films, which had gone towards fantasy, and I'm uncomfortable in that area myself, and I thought I wouldn't do it very well, so I wanted to pull the film back a little bit closer to reality. You can't ever make a Bond film very real, because it would get boring, and that's not the style of it. But I thought we could move away from fantasy a little bit, and the character of Carver gave us the key to doing that. Then I had a feeling that the classic Bond women were somewhat played out, and it would be great to have a very contemporary, smart, able woman as the co-star, as the other person with him, and perhaps this time to give him a real co-star, somebody who would be his equal. And my nephew, and I think Michael Wilson's son, came up with the same idea about the same time in October, and said, you should look at Michelle Yeoh.
Is this Michael Wilson's son, Greg?
Yes.
And your nephew, Angus?
Yes.
They
both, in the same weekend, they gave us each the same piece of firm advice with strict instructions to follow it. And soon after that, I was in Hong Kong and met Michelle and thought she was really wonderful. I'd seen some of her films. I then saw all of them. And she was absolutely the right person. And I think she brought a tremendous freshness to the film. And it was great for Pierce. He loved having it there. They played together very well, and it was very interesting.
Now, after the success of this film, Michelle has become a great star in the West, but prior to that, she was mainly a star in the Hong Kong cinema. Not that well known in the States or in Britain, but a tremendous star there.
Yes, she was, and I think people discovered her here, and yeah, she's been very well known in two-thirds of the world for a long time. But it's interesting that she's now known here, and I hope she finds the right material to go forward.
She was trained in the ballet.
In England, strangely enough. So she started in England. I think she went there when she was 8 or 9 and stayed till she was 16, so she has a more English accent than I do. And then she went back to Hong Kong, perhaps later than that, maybe when she was 18, and started a career with Jackie Chan, first of all in commercials and then in his films. And somewhere along the line she said, you know, you do all the stunts, why can't I do some? And she started training as a stunt woman and worked with a stunt group who actually, we had some of that same stunt group. And she learned to do her own stunts in Hong Kong. You have doubles, but not nearly as much as we use them here. So she actually learned to do almost everything and does it wonderfully. We're now in the Devonshire. This was also one of the scenes from the original script that was incorporated in the rewrite. And we went to Portsmouth to shoot all of this on a British frigate. We were lucky because we were able to use many of the sailors who worked the ships. So everyone in the control rooms is a real sailor.
All of this is absolutely authentic Royal Navy routine.
Yes. They were running through their routines, their battle preparation routines. And we adapted the script slightly, and in fact it conforms with all of the normal practices. It's wonderful having real people playing the extras, because they know exactly what to say and do, and you just get them started, and they create the real life of the place.
Bond films generally feature the villain having a marvelous lair or device or plan, and this is the villain's stealth boat, which is all of those combined into one.
We found a model, a plastic model kit, in the States with the U.S. Navy's only stealth ship, and this was based loosely on that. Ours is somewhat bigger, of course, and even more high-tech than the U.S. Navy, I suspect, but they look pretty much the same.
This sequence is shot with a combination, again, of models, which were shot in Mexico, am I right?
I think we moved on to the Titanic tank just within days of when they finished it. They went a little bit over, and we were holding our breath as to whether we could get there in time. But yes, John Richardson went to Mexico with the two models he'd built here, here in London, each 50-foot models, and they were put into the Titanic tank. So all the underwater stuff and the model ship stuff is done there.
And then you built a full-size stealth boat on the 007 stage at Pinewood, correct?
We built the inside right there, and this SeaVac was built there, which was a full-size machine. Unfortunately, we weren't able to make it out of plastic or rubber, and we ended up having to make it out of steel and aluminum, so it was a rather dangerous device that we were all a little nervous working around. Vic did a lot of this... these shots with the extras and the water tanks coming in. He did a wonderful job.
That's Vic Armstrong, the second unit director.
Yeah. Combination of the engine room was built at Frogmore. The Portsmouth stuff was actually done there. The control room stuff was done on the real ship and on their mock-up there. Portsmouth has a mock-up where they train their sailors, and we worked there as well.
These shots of the water bursting through the floor, how was that achieved physically?
They build big tip tanks, tanks that hold huge amounts of water, and that you can literally just tip over and the water pours down a chute and into the set. So you can deliver thousands of gallons of water into one place very, very quickly under an enormous pressure. The tanks are put quite high up, 20 or 30 feet in the air. And, of course, it takes a day to drain the whole thing and dry it off. It's a difficult, slow process. You can only do a few takes every day. And it's also quite dangerous. You're sending a huge weight of water into a restricted set.
All of the extras in there are stunt.
They're all stuntmen.
Performers.
Yes. On a Bond film, you quickly find out that you use all the stuntmen several times, I mean, in England. And there must have been 70 or 80 we used, and you start using them over and over again.
Incredible.
Our model sinking in Mexico, CGI jets going overhead, and now we're at the 007 stage. Mexico models and shots in Frogmore. More computer-generated planes.
Mr. Gupta's little trick with the encoder worked. They gave their final position 70 miles from here.
We spent an enormous amount of time working out this part of the premise, the encoder, the GPS system. Part of the story is based on being able to alter the GPS system. Of course, before you can do that, you have to really understand how it works before you can figure out a way that it might be modified.
I remember you telling me about... endless discussions, including reviews of articles in the Scientific American about the GPS system and how it works, dithering, which is a way of making the signal slightly more or slightly less precise to permit their use by civilians. All of that, I guess you have to have in your head, but you don't need to tell the audience.
No, but you have to somehow believe a reality to it. And but if explaining it, of course, would be very boring. But I think if you don't make these things make sense, then an audience often realizes that they don't make sense, and you lose a kind of tension and reality to the story. So you better have it worked out pretty well, even if you're never going to explain it completely.
The villain in this picture is played by Jonathan Pryce. You had him in mind from the beginning, didn't you?
I did. I thought the character was so interesting and needed to be somewhat larger than life. It's loosely based on a number of people one can think of who are media barons, and they all seem to be somewhat larger than life and and to enjoy the publicity more than you would expect, to be both public and private figures. And I'd seen Jonathan, obviously, in many films, but also in Miss Saigon, and I thought he had the capacity to be both very big and to fill the screen, and yet to always be truthful and believable and credible. So he has this wonderful range and a wicked sense of humor. And fortunately, he was free, and he was just finishing Evita. And he was happy to do it. It was great. He was a wonderful collaborator. We wanted to create this world for him, this sets of his media headquarters, very hard-edged, cold, technological places with endless video screens. Easy to put on paper, but of course when we started to make it all happen, you have to fill those screens. You have to send out film units to shoot enough to go onto various screens. You have to get them on the screens. This video wall that we have here has 130 or 40 screens on it, I think, and is used with making just a few images sometimes, but often many, many images. It very simply creates his world and gives his character a background and a setting, but it was very hard to achieve. I think our DP did wonderfully here. So much of the film has these video screens in it that Robert always had to film on Panavision lenses that have very little depth of field, and we had to shoot always at F2 or so to make these screens look alive. And Robert was a large part of giving the film a really wonderful look and making this style work for the villain all the way through and keeping a consistency between the units. And
now, let's see if I follow you technically. You mean that because the screens have a certain brightness that can't be increased, everything else has to be a little darker than one might normally have it?
That's right.
Which means that the lenses have to be wide open on the camera, which means that the focus is very shallow.
Anamorphic lenses have very little depth of field anyway. And if you have to shoot at very low light levels, when you're wide open, the depth of field is minimal. I haven't come across this really for many years, but I started that way on Under Fire when I was with John Alcott. And John was always happy shooting at F1 or F1.2. He was very happy if he had a candle in the shot or two candles in the shot. He always thought that was fine.
John Alcott won the Oscar for Barry Lyndon.
For Barry Lyndon.
Which made amazing use of candlelight.
That was the first film that was really shot at F1 and had hundreds of candles. And actually, when I worked with him on Under Fire, he'd reduced those hundreds of candles to just one or two, and he could shoot with almost nothing. It was almost pitch black when he shot, and there was no depth of field whatsoever for the actors. Well, this time we did a little bit better. We had a little bit more depth of field, but it was a constant constant difficulty that we were always shooting with these video screens, and I think Robert did wonderfully with it.
It means that the actors have the additional challenge of having to be very precise in their movements, right?
That's right. If they are 2 inches off their marks, then the shot's probably out of focus. You can't actually see it through the lens of the camera, but you'll see it in dailies. So the poor actors have to become almost automatons to work in it. Now, we've just gone right the way through Oxford without a word, but she really doesn't need very much explanation. We shot the scene very fast. It was very simple to do. They were both wonderful, and they were both excellent. And we finished, I think, at 11 o'clock, and so I called a wrap, and both actors said, wait a minute, we can do this for the rest of the day.
Oh, I bet they could. I bet they could. Dame Judi Dench, a wonderful actress, the new M. How was it to work with her?
She's so smart and so good. She was just going into a play right now. And we had her for perhaps a week, and she's just a delight to be with. The other actors love being with her. I had a wonderful cast here. Pierce, Jeffrey Palmer, Colin Salmon, Julian Fellowes. on a Bond film, you treasure the moments where you have actors talking. You spend so many days where you're doing one tiny moment of action, which may only be on the screen for a couple of seconds, and you spend the whole day preparing it and then shooting it, that to actually have the actors there and to play a scene is a real delight.
The press were already screaming for blood and knife. Now, Roger, you said earlier that the MI6 set, this set, is the same structure as the Carver Media Group headquarters, that fantastic room with all the video screens. It doesn't look at all the same.
In fact, the same as both of his headquarters. They were the same set again, redecorated and redesigned, and to some extent rebuilt. Even with a huge budget, you have to try and economize. We were building the stealth ship and so many other things that we found a way, Alan Cameron found a way of making all of this work and giving it a very, very different look.
He's your production designer.
Alan's the production designer. He did Air America, and he came back for this. He'd just done Starship Troopers when he came onto this. Here we are in the Daimler. I remember spending a very pleasant Sunday in the City of London. You get wonderful help from the police in the City of London. And that police escort behind us actually was closing down the roads and stopping traffic as we went, all on the move, so we could do the scene many, many times, which was necessary because the light was so difficult. Very bright sunshine, and then the clouds would come in. The actors were wonderful. They kept going for far too long because the light conditions were so difficult. And it was this rather nice scene that is full of exposition, but here they are in the Daimler going at 90 miles an hour through the City of London, sipping their drinks, their martinis and their scotch in a properly decorous fashion while they're racing along. This was one of the few scenes, I think, where the studio was unhappy. They saw it and they said, why would people drink? And surely drinking is decadent, and this isn't a proper thing for our characters to be doing. This is sort of loose morals. So it was a little strange on the Bond film. And we had to keep re-editing it so that closer and closer shots were used so you could see less of the drinking.
Well, Bond films, it calls for drinking, I think.
I always thought so. I much prefer the other version where you see them drinking and they're holding their drinks up as they swerve around corners and so forth. But apparently it offended some Puritan sensibility somewhere.
Roger, I came to visit you while you were in prep, and I got to meet an icon of the cinema, somebody I've grown up admiring, Desmond Llewellyn, who has played Q in all of the Bond films.
And knows more about Bond than almost anyone else, except for Barbara Michael. He's a very charming man. I hope I can be working when I'm his age and still be as strong and focused and funny. He has a wonderful sense of humor. He and Pierce clearly like each other enormously, and this scene was a pleasure to shoot.
Desmond told me that he thought that Pierce was one of the best Bonds ever. He was clearly not wanting to be disloyal to any of the other co-stars that he'd played with, but you could tell talking to him, and I think you can tell watching the film, that he really thinks Pierce is doing a great job.
And he is. Desmond thinks enormously of him, and Pierce on this film was such a pleasure to work with. He's so confident, he's so good at this character. He knows every inch of it, and he has fun with it. And Pierce also is a person of great grace and courage, and an extremely nice man. I don't think I've met another actor who has as much time for everyone else, who will speak to any person who comes and beards him on the set, who handles the pressures of being such a well-known person extraordinarily well. He's a very gracious man.
So that's what I've been doing wrong all these years.
Look. And they did have fun with this scene. They did enjoy it. Though Desmond had a little trouble with the phone at first.
And this I'm particularly proud of. The remote control for your car. Tap twice. One, two. Now, draw your finger very slowly across...
He really did wonderfully with the dialogue. He remembered his lines. He had fun with them. He changed them when he didn't like them. And he spoke, he said, I know more about this than other people do. And he only changed a couple, but he had his own viewpoint.
Now, this scene also introduces the remote-controlled BMW 750. You picked this car. It's an unusual choice for a Bond film, which has always had two-seater sports cars.
I did. I felt that in the last film they'd been restricted by the very small sports car, the M3, that BMW makes, and it was certainly going to be BMW this time. I missed all the great gizmos that the Aston Martins used to have, and I thought we should bring them back in this. And I needed a car that was both very, very fast and powerful, and would have room for rockets and all the traditional toys that go with the car. So I picked this one, and it did very well for us. Here we are at Carver's headquarters. We shot this at the IBM building near London Airport. We looked at more locations to shoot this scene than any other scene in the film, except perhaps the banner scene. It was a very difficult building to find, although it doesn't look it on screen. And it's a very deceptive building because although it has this enormous space, we ended up shooting on walkways and in very narrow areas most of the time.
There's even less truth in the rumor that I took 100 million francs from the French to keep the stories running for another year.
Excuse me, Mr. Carver?
Yes.
This is the new banker.
Every Bond film has Bond dressed up and it has a big party scene. Everyone has to have the high style.
Tell me, Mr. Bond, how is the market reacting to the crisis?
Michelle Yeoh is introduced here, and she's...
I don't believe we've met.
Dressed gorgeously as everybody else is in this scene. This scene is a real chance for the costume designer to shine.
Lindy Hemmings was our costume designer. She spent months on this scene. I don't think I really did her justice. There were some extraordinary futuristic costumes, and we don't get very much of a chance to see them. I think this was one of the scenes that I felt most disappointed. I didn't feel quite comfortable in the set, in the location, and it's a little bit dead on. It's not as interesting as it ought to be. It's beautifully lit. We added those laser beams to try and spike it up a little bit. Here we are with Terry Hatcher. She arrived just days before she shot this. I met her at once in L.A. She was very nice and funny and smart and perfect for the character. But was shooting something else at the time, so arrived just a couple of days before we started shooting.
She must have been exhausted, but she doesn't look it.
No, she's a real actress. I think she'd had about 8 hours sleep.
Mrs. Carver will have a tequila. Straight shot.
No, Mrs. Carver will have a glass of Mr. Carver's champagne.
Early on in the script development process, this part of the film was going to take place in Seville, and we had an extraordinary 18th century palace for the party. And then after many, many rewrites and rethinks, we eventually moved from Seville to Hamburg, and with it a more techno style.
That techno style is very evident here, and I've noticed in every scene that Jonathan Pryce is in.
We'd started from the very beginning, we wanted to change him from the way he's normally seen on the Infinity commercials, and so we tried many different hairstyles, eventually found those wonderful glasses that are very techno, they're extremely light and flexible, and Lindy spent months on his wardrobe, but slowly we created a hard-edged, modern character, and expanded that then into these sets. Used a lot of neon, lit into the camera lenses, so we got blue flares. So we got those blue flares. It gives it a kind of coldness. And then took those designs and that kind of lighting and put them into the stealth ship, which we kept very blue and metallic.
It's fascinating. The it started from the inside of this character and worked its way out into hair and glasses and wardrobe and out from there into sets and lighting.
And into what goes onto the computer screens, into every part of it, yes. And it's trying to get all these separate parts right and having a crew that is so good will take ideas and run with them and then coordinate them so that you end up with a unified style, that even though the film's being made by 800 people in different countries, you have one idea or one set of ideas that are cohesive that run throughout the film. And this was an enjoyable character to work with. I think Jonathan and I, this was really Bruce's strongest, it was the strongest part of the story and the thing he came up with first. I think this, the idea for this character was the very beginning of the script for him. And from that character, he started to evolve a story. It was a very nice idea, very smart idea. A character that is both funny and powerful and amoral, truly amoral. And I think it's a character that resonates rather well for all of us now.
Well, certainly the couldn't be more relevant today. The media baron whose success depends in great part on bad news.
Yes.
And it's probably a small step from today's reality to the Bondian world in which the villain will create his own bad news for bigger ratings.
Absolutely. Many people think that that goes on a little bit at the moment anyway. And of course they're all obsessed with expanding their empires, as is our character, who feels he must have China to feel better about his life. We're back in the same media set that we've used several times as MI6 here.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are live in 5.
Pierce is so good at making this work.
2.
It's the hardest thing for an actor, I think, to sit and wait for hours and hours and hours and then come in and be absolutely right for the few moments that you need to be there. To be focused at all times and yet not to be burnt up by all the waiting. It's a very long shoot, 125 days. And to always be focused when you need to be. It's very difficult.
I imagine that all of these sets took many, many hours to light.
Well, quite a bit, but less than I would have thought. Robert was very fast, and we staged the action quite quickly, and Robert would go away, and pretty soon we moved quite well through all of this. We'd all looked forward to shooting this big Carver speech with this vast screen behind him, and actually months of work had gone into the images that are on the screens behind him and designing where they would be at any point. And we had fun contrasting this fight in a recording studio, which of course is soundproof, so whatever goes on in here cannot be heard outside, even by the guards in this guard in the next room.
Yeah, I think this is very funny that we can't hear from that room what's
yeah,
going on
it's a
inside.
Very nice idea. In fact, I think we had a real scheduling problem, and I'd got behind a little bit, and we were trying to catch up. And I think Michael came up with the idea, could you stage the fight off-screen to some extent and therefore not have to cover it? Would there be some way of seeing it through a window and staying away from it and not having to shoot an enormously detailed fight? We felt we had a lot of action scenes already, and it was a very smart idea.
That's and Michael Wilson, the
Michael Wilson,
producer.
The producer. Yeah. He and Barbara produced it. And it was a clever idea, and it made it a quite a different kind of action scene. And it was funny, and I find personally that violence in films is quite troubling. And this is a film in which we could have a lot of action, but not actually a lot of bloodshed, and keep the level of violence quite down. And that was rather important for me. And these were action scenes, therefore, that became humorous and that were enjoyable without having to have blood and gore and real extreme violence on screen.
It's more of a comic book. Kind of violence.
It's a comic book kind of violence. This was a wonderful set to work in. We were able to move the camera an enormous amount. I think I thought originally we'd be using a lot of Steadicam work, but with the low light levels and the difficulty of keeping everything in focus, we ended up on the dolly, and I think that's Robert's style as well. The whole film was really shot with extended dolly and crane shots, and very little was actually done with a Steadicam, unless it was on the back of a motorbike or something. I haven't really talked about Gertz Otto, but he did very well.
He's the physical villain of the movie.
Yes, he and Ricky Jay between them are the dangerous presences. Ricky, we'll talk about him later. Ricky's
he plays Gupta. He's the more intellectual one, and Otto plays the more brute strength guy.
That's right. But originally, I think I was drawn to Ricky. I'd seen Ricky 20 years ago. Ricky is a master of close magic, but can also throw a mean card into a wall. And the cards, when you see him do his display, he can cut a watermelon in two or pierce one, and the cards look terrific. He's incredibly skillful with them. He can throw them across the room, he can stick them in anything. He's very accurate with them. And it seemed that this might be a strange kind of replacement for Oddjob. But when we actually got it on camera, playing cards flying across a room never looked as impressive as they should have done. And no matter how we managed to film it, it never seemed to be very threatening, and eventually we removed all of it. It was a great shame.
Yes, it's too bad. Some things that look very impressive in person, and the fact that you know that that they're actually being done, aren't impressive in a movie when anything can be done.
Exactly. It's why magic is so hard to film. When you're there and see it happen in front of you, it's very impressive. If you put it on film, everyone assumes it's a camera trick. This is one of my favorite scenes here. It's a very small one. Very clever scene that Bruce had written. Very good character moment. Alan built these little rooms off this large set so that we could get away from our characters, and here I wanted to be well away from Price and get a sense of his empire in front of him, these small but very powerful figures. This is supposed to be the interior of the Hamburg Hotel, but in fact we adapted a room at a golf course just outside London called Stoke Poges. I think this was the first scene that we did with Terry after she arrived. And she was strapped into that wonderful creation that comes off so easily.
This is a very small, intimate scene. Depending on performance.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach it from the standpoint of staging it?
I rehearse with the actors, usually for an hour or so beforehand.
This is before any lighting or...?
Before any lighting. The set has been picked or created with the staging in mind, but I don't tell the actors the staging. I kind of know what would be the best in the set, or we've built the set for that reason. But I like to go into the set without telling the actors how we're going to stage it. And we start reading the scene and finding the words and bringing it to life. And take a lot of time, or as much time as necessary, usually half an hour or an hour, just with me and probably Robert Elswit, the DP in the room, and the script supervisor, Angela. And the scene evolves, and if the actors need help in staging, I give them hints. I'd like them to find it themselves if possible, but then they feel more connected with it rather than telling them to go there, do this, and do that. And I think actors enjoy that far more, and they start to fly with the material. So we would go in, and I think we spent about an hour rehearsing this with the first AD Jerry looking rather nervously that our day is going by. But I've always found that if you don't make it really work beforehand, there's no point starting to shoot.
Then once the actors have rehearsed it and you feel that it's playing well, then you go to work on where to put the camera and how to shoot it?
Well,
or is that going on simultaneously?
That's kind of going on simultaneously. As the scene is evolving, Robert and I are watching it, and we're usually with sort of silent signals between each other. We're working out whether it can be shot as well as we'd prepared, whether these really are, whether it's developed in the right way. And we have a sense of how we're going to shoot it anyway. We've picked a location where we know all the best angles. We know where it really ought to be headed. So I engineer the actors gently into close to what we'd planned. And we've already in preparation, we've come in with the equipment we know we need. We wanted to keep the camera moving a lot of the time. I wanted to keep it, prevent the film becoming static, prevent it becoming slow. I wanted the story to have a lot of energy, and I felt that the camera should always be moving. It should always be connected to the audience, should be quite visceral. And so whenever possible, we built moves into it and came in, and you come in with the equipment anyway for that. And it's all planned.
The and this is during the preparation stages when you're first visiting the sets, when they're being constructed or the locations are being picked?
Yes. I mean, you pick them both for the look that they give you immediately and also for what you can do within them. Do you have enough space to move around? All these sets are somewhat oversized, and we often shot them smaller than they really were. We would decide up front how much camera movement, how much equipment we'd need, and we'd build sets often oversized and plan to shoot them so much smaller.
I don't understand how you mean. The sets are large and you make them look smaller? Or?
Yes, you decide how large they should look, and you can shoot a big set and make it look smaller. It's very hard to shoot in a small set and either make it look bigger or
just physically move
around
to
in
move.
It and,
yeah.
and do the kind of camera moves that you want to do. If you're restricted for space, it really limits you. And much as I like real locations, sets give one far more flexibility with lighting, and you can knock out the walls and you can move the camera more. I think on Under Fire I started off thinking everything should be real, and now I've got to the point where I think everything should be sets.
Oh, right. So, but to make a set look smaller, you're just staging in a smaller area of the set, or?
And using different lenses and different kinds of move.
Now we're going into the original part of Carver's media empire, his printing press for his international newspaper, Tomorrow, which is, of course, part of the title, Tomorrow Never Dies.
We were able to use the Daily Telegraph and the Evening Standard in London and shot most of the scene there, combined with the part here at the IBM building. And here, of course, we've used wide lenses. We've expanded his empire somewhat. Those were great glass roofs. And we found this area actually at IBM and then rebuilt it on the stage as well. So this is a combination of stage and location. Now we're on the set. We're back at Frogmore. This is a set we built. A set that we must have designed five times. Every time we found a new location for the rest of the scene, we had to redesign this particular set. And in the end, Alan came up with something that was almost all glass, and we could light in different ways depending on where the rest of our location ended up. So he found an all-purpose set. It was very cleverly designed, and Robert lit it entirely from the outside, so we get these big panels of light.
Interesting editing challenge in this sequence. Obviously, the concealed item can't be in the first place that Bond looks. And we've got to get the impression that he's been searching for a long time. And one does from that
yes.
quick sequence. And yet, you can't spend a lot of time.
No. I think in the past I've tended to shoot the whole sequence and then turn it into a montage. But this time we didn't have We were a little behind schedule, and we didn't have enough time to shoot very much, so we actually shot the whole thing as a montage. So all these separate elements were just shot as such. They weren't. It was never staged throughout as a complete scene. They were just fragments that added up to this.
And it worked very effectively.
We were editing simultaneously in the same building, so we were able to put together scenes very quickly and get a sense of whether they were working and how little we could shoot to make it all work.
You had a release date, in effect, before you had a start date on the picture.
Absolutely. We were initially supposed to be that ready for Thanksgiving, and although we were, the release date was moved to Christmas. But from the very beginning, we knew we only had about a month of editing post-production, that from the end of the shooting we would have to be locked within 3 or 4 weeks. So the film had to be conceived and built as we went along.
Now, and you had to supervise the editing of the film as the...
I was popping in and out all the time. Here we had a lot of fun with these big tracking shots through all of this glass. It was a very tricky building. It was, as you can see, it's all filled with glass, and we weren't allowed to break any of the glass panes, so it was hard to give it a real energy and danger. We used an awful lot of bullet hits and a constantly moving camera. Michelle did her own stunt here. Walking down a wall was trickier than it looks. She makes it look very easy. And now we're into the real print works of the Daily Telegraph. Some quick shots, that long lens shots, that before we get up to the crane. Vic did some shooting here, and then we came in. I think I went way over on the schedule. It was a very hard place to shoot, and putting Pierce up there, everyone had to be strapped in at all times. We were going across these huge machines. There they are. And nothing can drop into those machines without wrecking the print line. And if you fall into them, of course, that's it. They're very, very dangerous. And we were up on this crane for probably 2 days with Pierce, and then another day as he jumped down, got off them. This is all handheld. I think one of the few places where we were using multiple cameras. Vic always shot with 5 or 6 cameras. I tried to use only one camera most of the time. But for this scene, I think we used 2.
Why only one camera for the main unit?
Because I think in most cases there's only one really good angle and at a time. And the second camera is always compromised. It's always got a longer lens, or it's in slightly the wrong place. So if you can do things one shot at a time, it really does work better. You can't do that for action scenes, but on any kind of dialogue scene, and scene where you're with your main characters, it's often hard to get a second camera as good as the first one, and I tried not to do it. But this kind of scene, we've got 3 or 4 cameras. Here we are in the print storage room. This was one of the few sequences we didn't shoot. We had an enormously complicated action scene with those vast rolls of paper, and we designed it and storyboarded it, and in the end didn't have time to shoot it, and in the end, in fact, didn't need it. So it was a good thing we didn't make it, but it was a very good scene. Back in Hamburg, before we shot this scene, Pierce had been in an accident, a small accident while we'd been shooting something from the end of the film in the stealth boat, and Pierce had got hurt, and his upper lip had been sliced open. He had many, many stitches in, 8 or 10 stitches, and this whole week that we shot in Hamburg doing this exterior work, he had a very ugly scar on his, or wound on his upper lip. And so all the shots had to be redesigned so that the camera wouldn't see it.
So it couldn't really be covered by makeup. It had to be just kept off camera as much
exactly,
as possible.
Exactly, yes. We were told that if we put makeup on it, it would delay the healing. So we didn't do that. We just rearranged the shots so that you could never see it. Now we're coming to my favorite scene, I think. The scene with Dr. Kaufman. Back in Hamburg. Our tracking shot, again, what would have been a Steadicam shot, but we ended up doing them on dollies. We found, I think every film you find your own shooting style, and I've done films which have had Steadicams. I did Hiroshima. That was all handheld, entirely handheld. And this one we'd planned Steadicam, and within the first few weeks we'd found we were only using long dolly shots. This is the Stoke Purchase set, a real location with some alterations made by us. Very large space. It was very good. It has a wonderful look, and I think Robert lit it beautifully here. We wanted this sense of early morning, of light flooding in, and pastel shades on the walls.
A body was discovered along with the body of an unidentified man who appeared to be the victim of a self-inflicted gun wound. Reached the body's private jet and moved to see.
Pierce is wonderful in the scene.
It's a very, very tough scene for him to play.
Yes.
Because the scene has an essentially a comic premise, and he can't depart from the reality of the film that
absolutely
this woman has just died.
Yes, he has to remain completely grounded. He has almost nothing to say, and yet the scene hinges around him. And here's Vincent, who is having a wonderful time with it, exploring his German accent. And Pierce keeps it grounded and keeps it very real and filled with emotion for her. Dr. Kaufman. Vincent Schiavelli playing Dr. Kaufman. He's a very interesting actor who I'd seen so many times, mainly in the Milos Forman films. And he always plays these quirky, quixotic, strange characters. And he manages to make this very dry, very funny, and very German. I remember when the BMW executives came by, they happened to see this scene, and they assumed he was a German actor who they just hadn't seen before.
Oh, terrific.
Believe me, Mr. Bond, I could shoot you from Stuttgart and still create the proper effect.
Herr Stanford.
My art is in great demand, Mr. Bond. I go all over the world. I am especially good at the celebrity overdose. But now I am afraid, Mr. Bond, that our little... Stamper! Stop yelling in my ear, yeah?
You lost 18 cars? You went through 18 BMWs doing this sequence?
We wrecked about 15 of them. We knew we always would. We had to rebuild them, of course, to put the hidden driver in. Our driver sits in the back on the floor. And then we wrecked a lot of them. But, you know, there were crashes we planned for. We threw them off the top of the building. We lost, I think, 3 that way. And some of them weren't really wrecked, but they were so altered that they could never be driven again.
I am to torture you if you don't do it.
You have a doctorate in that, too?
No. This is more like a hobby. But I'm very gifted.
Oh, I believe you. My cell phone opens the
car. No, Mr. Bond. I do it, yeah?
We're coming up to the car chase now. That occupied a lot of my time and everyone's time very early on. I knew we had to have a car chase, but there have been so many thousands of car chases. The real question was how could one ever do one that was essentially different from previous car chases? And finally, I went through it so many times, I came to the conclusion the only way you could make it really different would be to put the driver in the back seat. And the moment I did that, we had the chase. Everything else fell into place. We were able to use the telephone then as a remote control device, and it became almost like a video game in a sense. Pierce could be in the back seat and could play the character. He didn't have to do all the driving, at least have both hands on the steering wheel. He was much freer to move around, and it became a more interesting scene. So we storyboarded that, and Vic and I went through it many times, and we added shots and moments. Chris Corbett came up with some very clever ideas and came up with the chain-cutting device and various things that we could put into the car. And from that, we developed the story in pictures, and then started to work out how to shoot it. And I think Vic spent a month here working on this with a hidden driver, remote cameras, and a very fast follow car that he built that could go at 70 or 80 miles an hour. The car accelerates from the ramp where it goes up at about 15 miles an hour. It seems to get, I think it gets to about 70 before it breaks and turns the corner. It was very quick.
It must have been enormously technically difficult to have to drive this car, to get this car moving safely. Without a visible driver.
Yeah, Steve, who's under the back seat there, and is driving this with just looking at video screens that are hidden. The cameras are hidden in the wing mirrors. He was very courageous, very fast. He spent months learning how to do it on a runway with just bollards up, until he was confident that he could drive at this speed with a crew around him and not get into serious trouble.
So, in effect, The scene is about a guy in the back seat driving by remote control, and in order to get that, you actually had to have a guy in the back seat driving by remote control.
Just everything was slightly different, but that's right. Yeah. This was very carefully storyboarded and shot by shot. Often these shots that look so easy, Vic would be there for a day, and I'd speak to him at the end of the day, be exhausted. He'd spend a day trying to put a rocket through a fast-moving car. It was extremely difficult. The rockets run on wires, and they take an enormous amount of rigging. You can spend 4 hours, and then it doesn't work. I think the follow car that he designed gave this tremendous energy. We wanted all the shots to be moving, and so many of them, you find this tracking car.
The follow car, meaning a car that from which it you're
yes.
shooting?
Yeah, car to car. We also had a real concern about whether you could ever keep a sense of geography. A story, an action scene loses all tension if you don't know where you are and who's in front and what's going on. And here we were shooting in a car park that had five identical floors. And although we painted each floor slightly differently, we were in fact using only one level. And you see the same thing over and over again, and hopefully always have a clear sense of where you are. Pierce was very good. He understood that this was completely his scene. We were with him for about 10 days here. After Vic had been there for 3 or 4 weeks, we came in and spent 10 days with Pierce in the back seat, a camera strapped on the outside, and he was thrown from side to side. He sometimes had his feet out of the back window. It was impossible for him to stay stable, and yet he made it all about his character with humor. He was suave even when he was being thrown around. He really made the scene. All these action scenes only really work if they're also character pieces. If they just become exercises in technology, they get dull very quickly. If they come out of character and if they're rooted to a main character, they are much stronger. We ended up with, I hope, a really good scene. BMW were very, very helpful. It can only be made with a company that had an enormous amount of technological resources and were very generous with their time.
GPS calibration unit. Oh, by the way, you know that officially, Uncle Sam is completely neutral in this turkey shoot.
And unofficially?
We have no interest in seeing World War III.
This scene is set on Okinawa. Was it shot in Okinawa?
Unfortunately, no. We all wanted to go to Okinawa, but we didn't get there. We went to Lake and Heath in Norfolk, or Essex, and US Air Force Base. They were extremely generous with their time, and lent us all his jets, flew them through shots when we needed them, or told us when we could do our takes. It was a fabulous helicopter that that Pierce arrives in, which is from Vietnam, from the Vietnam era. We were here for a couple of days, freezing.
You could slowly send a ship off course.
Kind of like putting a magnet beside a compass.
Yeah, exactly.
Then check this out.
Oh, yeah. Those two circles should be lining up on top of each other. Somebody's tampered with your encoder.
If we knew the last time and position the Devonshire thought she was, could you figure out exactly where she sank?
Sure.
Wait.
Yeah.
I have a small favor to ask.
The next sequence is shot actually in a hangar at Laken Heath, inside the plane, rocking the camera. I think actually some of this was handheld as well. We were trying to get a little bit of movement into it. And I think actually we ended up with two cameras here. We could only stay one day, and Pierce was having a miserable time wearing a wetsuit, overheating. So we had a long lens camera and something closer.
This is not a set then. This is the inside of a real plane.
Of a real plane that's actually in a hangar at Laken Heath. I spent a lot of time inside this plane because I think we had 3 weeks shooting on Air America inside this same design plane. It looks as if you're going to have an enormous amount of space, but when you put a crew inside there, you've got 30 or 40 people and the actors, it becomes very small. Now we have him jumping out. We had blue screens everywhere outside the plane. It was very difficult to achieve in the hangar. We spent a lot of time. Very hard to get a lighting balance outside of a stage. Creating blue screens on location is very difficult. Get the right balance. And we were trying to get a shot where we would go with the camera, but with the actor and go out of the camera at least halfway. And in the end, I think we didn't use that. I think it wasn't worth it.
You didn't even say goodbye.
This sequence became very difficult technically because two things. First of all, the wetsuit filled with air and turned the diver into a Michelin man. Then when we solved that, we found that the tanks, you can actually see that they're somewhat different shots. They're different colors from shot to shot. They are different colors, in fact. Some shots we redid and some we didn't. We had to redesign those tanks to make them more aerodynamic because the tanks slowed him down and the cameraman, not wearing tanks, kept going faster, so we could never get a shot that lasted for more than a second or two. I think we must have shot for 6 or 8 weeks doing this, redesigning the tanks every day, redesigning the outfit, putting tanks on the cameraman to see if that would slow them down. It was extremely difficult to work out the speed everyone was falling and get a shot that really lasted 4 or 5 seconds.
Now, how was it achieved that you have a diver going down to what is presumably not a full-size ship, but it appears full size in that shot?
Yes, there's a model shot, and then right afterwards there's just a one set piece. That's a piece of the side of the ship that's probably 30 feet by 15. And that was, and this is the 007 stage. We were shooting the interior of the stealth ship up above, and down here Pete Romano was working at night, and I would come in at night and watch it on the screens, and we'd shoot this underwater sequence at night in underwater sets about 16 feet down. We got caught with some complicated electrical issue that meant that people felt that we could only work on a different power setup at a different time of day. So the underwater crew was shot at night.
Because if a light, for example, were to fall off the main set into the water,
we might have electrocuted everyone. That was the concern. These were very difficult to light. We lit, in fact, through the roof, through grills in the roof, so that we could shoot in any direction down here. You'd never see anything. But we were in an enclosed set. It was difficult for the actors.
It must have been very claustrophobic if they're working underwater and there's a ceiling above them.
And there's closed doors around them. Even though there are safety divers all around, it's very scary. I think they both did extremely well with that. Pete Romano came over from Los Angeles. He has a wonderful setup. He does an enormous amount of underwater work. And he spent about a month with us. They have a video, two video cameras. Well, there's the one hooked through the film, and you get a live feed of that on the surface. And then there's another video camera that just watches what's going on, so you can see where all the players are on the camera and the actors. So you can actually sit above the tank and send messages down through speakers to all of them. And you can watch what's happening within the camera and also on the set itself. This scene really comes alive with our sound effects. We had a tremendous sound effects team who had extremely little time at the end. Because of our very fast post-production, all of these people started earlier. And David Arnold, the composer, in fact, I hired well before the start of shooting. And he started scoring early on, probably in the first 3 or 4 weeks of shooting. He was writing the score. My editors cut and add music immediately, and so even very early cuts had music, some of it David's and some we brought in from other films. So we had an active temp track and effects track within the first month of shooting, and David would look at it, and he started writing the score very early. And I think our first scoring was halfway through the shoot, our first scoring session.
But that would mean that the film had to be cut exactly to time, correct? In order for the score to be written? And
well, it had to be pretty close. That meant that even while early in the shooting, we were fine cutting. This was... We knew that to make our dates, we had to keep everything incredibly tight. And in fact, we previewed about a week after the end of shooting, and that was within a minute of the final length of the film. So it was very tightly timed, very tightly edited, and the score fitted very, very closely to it.
The sound work, the post-production sound, also had to start before it would normally?
They started in the middle of the shoot. Yeah, there was no way they were going to be able to do it afterwards, so they started building these libraries. They went abroad, they recorded in Bangkok and Thailand and Vietnam, and we are in fact supposed to be in Vietnam right now. Here's Carver's main office in Saigon, which we shot in Bangkok.
Originally, you were going to shoot in Saigon, in Ho Chi Minh City.
We had three trips there, I think, and had found a terrific building to work in, had got permission from the Vietnamese government, and then at the very last moment, they decided that it was too much capitalism at one time. It was too big a change. It would give them too much publicity, and they backed off and they reneged, in fact. And we had to make a quick decision, and I'd worked in Bangkok a couple of times before, and Vic had been there several times, and we went there, and within 3 or 4 days, I think, had replaced our locations and found a crew.
Now, Carver's... the Carver Media Group Asian headquarters is again that same great room.
It's the same set modified.
This morning in Vietnam. Lacks punch, don't you think?
Oh, it's old news, Elliot. We've been working together for months.
Both our governments know what you and General Chang are up to.
I don't think so. You may have seen the
general. Rehearsed this for several hours with them, with Jonathan, and I always felt it was too static, and yet when we tried to move it around more, it became less. The actors became uncomfortable. So this seemed to be the truth of how it should be played, but I felt it was less interesting than it should be. Once again, we had the screens behind, and we had to use the screen, so we were restricted by that. And in the end, I don't think it matters too much, but I didn't think the scene came out quite as well as it could have done. I think I failed on it a little bit.
When you... obviously, you have a plan going in, and in this instance, that plan you felt wasn't working right. That the plan to move the camera more was not what the how the actors felt.
That's
natural,
right?
Playing the scene. So now you have to basically throw away your shot list and reimagine it on the spot?
Yes. I mean, in this case, it was very easy. What we ended up with was so conventional, in fact, it was very easy to figure out how to shoot it. What we'd started with was something more imaginative and involved lots of very long camera moves around the room with counter moves from Jonathan. But the more we rehearsed it, the less he moved. The speeches were very strong. They didn't need very much staging, and the more, as he did it time again, it became more static, and it was clear that it was right that way.
As the helicopter approaches the exterior of this set, we see an enormous banner with Jonathan Pryce's face.
That banner became a tremendous challenge to us. I think it was Vic who first came up with the idea of a little homage to a film with a saber going through a sail.
That was the great Thief of Baghdad with Douglas Fairbanks, right?
And he lets himself down the mainsail by plunging a sword into the sail and using that to slow him down. So we created this banner, and we were going to use a knife, actually, stabbed through the banner to slow down their descent. But first we had to find a building that we could put such a huge banner on, and we designed a banner that was, I think, 400 feet high. We went out to Kuala Lumpur, and we're going to shoot at the Petronas Towers, hang the banner in between them. But after several trips and much negotiation with engineers and people who understood about wind pressures and so forth, that became impossible, and we moved everything to Saigon, found another building, and we ended up in Bangkok with this building. I had originally decided that this would probably have to be shot with CGI, almost all CGI, and then we discovered that computer-generated images don't do flags and things being blown in the wind very well. It never looks quite real. So we moved away from CGI and finally had to figure out a way to actually do it pretty much for real. And so we built a section of this building, about 8 or 10 stories in Frogmore, and broke the banner into several pieces and used the real actors and dropped them down in front of the in front of the banner, section by section. Day after day, it was a very slow process. It was very painful for them. They were marvelously sympathetic about it, and even though it was painful and difficult, they kept up their humor, and somehow after 10 days, I think we had our full 20 seconds of the banner scene.
Painful physically?
Physically painful. From hanging from those ropes, even though they were wearing safety harness. Vic shot some material with Wendy and the other doubles at Bangkok for the wide shots, hanging them from the roof, and we combined them all. I think there's two CGI shots left in there, and the rest is real.
There's a marvelous moment that we just passed with as they get on this motorcycle for this chase, in which they both try and get into the driver's position. I understand that you played a little trick on the actors. Is that too strong to say?
Well, I mentioned to Michelle quietly away from Pierce that she should be sure that she drove the bike away, that she was on the front. And I mentioned to Pierce separately, and not saying I'd spoken to Michelle, that he should please be sure that Michelle didn't drive the bicycle. And so they both set off. We did that. That's the film has the first take in it, Take one with the best, and they both had conflicting
instructions. That's great. Yes. And were they good humored about that?
They were very good humored. By then, they were in a very friendly way. They were competitive. They enjoyed each other. They could ad lib scenes. They were really having fun together. We'd been shooting for about 6 weeks at this point, and they'd become quite good friends, and they were enjoying each other. I think that's the most fun, is when actors can occupy their characters so well that they can ad-lib fairly freely.
Now, this must have been the most extraordinarily complicated scene to shoot.
Again, endlessly storyboarded, very carefully worked out. Then re-storyboarded as we changed locations. Vic and I went around many, many different cities. We found this. We looked first of all in Kuala Lumpur, then in Saigon. We looked in Hanoi. Finding this rooftop was extremely difficult. And when we were shooting in Saigon, we were actually going to build about half a mile of rooftop in the middle of the city. When we lost Vietnam and moved to Bangkok, we found this almost immediately, and that decided, made it very simple. A simple choice to go there. And I think Vic was up here for about 10 days with motorcycles, sidecars to track this. Jean-Pierre doing the riding. He was again doing a lot of parallel shooting. We had an aerial unit here as well. This is all very carefully boarded. Now we're in Frogmore, and the street that Alan Cameron built, he built a very, very good street for us. You really felt you were in Saigon.
We're on the studio now.
We're at Frogmore, just outside London, and we're on the edge of the street that he built. It's about a quarter of a mile long.
It's seamless. You can't tell where the real location leaves off and the set begins.
We were lucky with weather, and the light was very, very similar. The set is terrific. Pierce and Michelle really make this work. And some of this is doubles, some of it is them, and they really make it feel like they've done the whole thing, and they did a lot of it. This is chapter 5, I think, of the sequence. We had probably 10 minutes storyboarding, and we cut it down to 8 minutes. The balcony's collapsing. Very carefully prepared and built by Chris Cobalt. It's the helicopter through the market. During Air America, we had a very close accident. Almost an accident with a helicopter. Somebody put something, a tire iron, into the blade of the helicopter, and a very thick tire iron, and snapped it off. And I realized then that these blades really can go through can chew up a lot of things. And so when we came to a bike chase, the helicopter seemed to be an excellent antagonist. I liked the tank chase in GoldenEye. I thought he did a wonderful job with that. It was very funny and exciting and witty. So in finding the central scene for this film, I felt I was in some way in competition with the tank. And rather than try and put Pierce into a huge vehicle, I decided to go the opposite way and make him David against Goliath. So we put him on the most vulnerable form of transport, a motorbike, and his opposition was a helicopter that could chew up everything behind him. Mm-hmm. And Vic found Jean-Pierre Goy, who's a brilliant bike rider, stunt rider.
It's also a great comic premise for this sequence that they're handcuffed together.
Yes.
That's something that's really out of romantic comedy, isn't it?
It is, yes. It always seemed to me the best way to make them have to work out a relation quickly without a lot of dialogue, that if you handcuff them together and put them on a bike and see how they both learn to ride it together, we would connect the characters very, very quickly. We're in Bangkok, doing the shower scene, but a little bit of coverage shot in Frogmore. We could only shoot this, the light was only good at 4 o'clock. It was picked, I eventually found an east-west alleyway, it was hard to find, and we're looking right into the sunset. So there was a tiny window when the light got very good. From morning till about 3 o'clock it was hideous, and then sometime around 3:30 or 4 we were backlit, and we were good to 6. At 4:15 the clouds came in and it went to hell again. So we ended up actually shooting the scene in 5 takes in about 25 minutes during the course of the day, all between 4 and 6.
Wow.
And that was partly why it was staged in a very simple way, though the shower restricts you as well. But it's, in essence, just a tracking shot done on 2 sizes. There's always this balance between good light and the number of angles you can shoot. And that was one of the places where we had a very straightforward scene that it was just worth the chance of shooting it in a very short time with very few angles, but getting the light exactly right. I had a very big scene in Under Fire towards the end where Joanna Cassidy flees through the city as it's falling apart, and that had to be shot in half an hour flat just when the sun was in exactly the right spot, and it's all done with one take. Normally I'd rather have far more angles, but there are moments when it's worth it.
This is Michelle Yeoh's scene that shows her action heroine capabilities, but it's a scene that is so like those of the Hong Kong cinema that made her a star. Were you conscious of those films as you shot this
one? Of doing it in her style, yes. She has these great qualities, and she actually does all these stunts. She's extraordinarily fast. I knew that we had to have a scene where we could really see them. And the best way to do that was to make it almost entirely a Hong Kong scene. And so we brought in the people who work with her. They do all that stuff. There's one moment, this one here, where I think it's where we had a double. The rest of the time, they're contact. They don't know how to miss. They don't like to miss. They're much better when they actually have full contact.
When they actually hit each other.
They hit each other. In America and Europe, the stuntmen miss each other. They're extremely adept at making it look like a hit. In Hong Kong, they hit each other. They may not always hit with the full impact that you would have in a real fight, but they certainly hit each other very hard. She kicked him, and he hit the wall right there. She was amazing at that. There's a tremendous style in those Hong Kong films. They've got enormous energy. I became fascinated with them and saw... I've also found with John Woo, looking at John Woo's films, I could see so much of Peckinpah in them. The early Peckinpah films, The Wild Bunch, Straw Dogs that I worked on.
Now, you were an editor working with Sam Peckinpah for many years.
For The Getaway and Pat Garrett, yes, as well as Straw Dogs. And so I came to Sam right after The Wild Bunch, where he'd really explored slow motion, and he was very affected by, very influenced by Kurosawa. And he would talk a lot about Kurosawa and what he'd learned from him. And I must confess, I spent an awful lot of time reducing the amount of slow motion in the film because it became excessive. But he used it very wonderfully in The Wild Bunch and to some extent in The Getaway. So it's strange and wonderful to see John Woo using some of the same techniques, copying Peckinpah, who in turn was copying Kurosawa, and everyone is referring to their predecessors and enjoying doing so.
And you got to enjoy referring back to Peckinpah at some arm's length.
That's right.
In this sequence.
Either missile into China.
And we will retaliate.
Michelle has... It's not just that she can do this physical stuff very well. She has an enormous inner strength and confidence. She's extremely quick, but it all comes out of a kind of balance, an internal balance. She's very centered as an actor and as a person. And so her movements, which are extremely fast, are always surprising, but they're always very poised and relaxed. She was a real pleasure to work with.
It's just like home. You get the equipment.
Now, this is a scene that's usually seen in a different way in a Bond film. This is in effect
the Q scene.
The Q scene.
That's right. We all felt that we had given Desmond short shrift, and that the nature of the story meant that we couldn't spend very long with him. But it would have been much better to have had a real Q scene with his lab and so forth. And this was the only way we could fit it into the story, and then it became a Chinese Q scene. In fact, we did have a Chinese Q in the scene for a while. She met her boss, and he set off some of these things. But once again, in compressing the story, we lost Chinese Q. We kept his lab, and Pierce became the one who worked it all.
The boat is traveling at a speed of 30 knots.
This is an area where the special effects people, Chris Corbelt and his crew, had a wonderful time designing some of these and making them work.
According to this, there are four places where
he... One of the things people always enjoy in a Bond film is the gadgets. And
there's a competition on the set as to how one can get the best gadgets, what would be the best gadgets. One keeps getting quick anonymous notes, some of them not anonymous, but often a little anonymous note saying this would be the perfect gadget or that would. And the crew is wonderful at that. And, of course, one's relatives and friends come up with them as well. But you start off thinking we'll never get any gadgets into it, and in the end you actually have a lot to pick through.
I've got it. Look. Four missing boats, three unexplained drownings. That has to be it. Ha Long Bay.
This is the most spectacular.
It's very beautiful, isn't it? It's Phuket. We were trying to make it look like Ha Long Bay, which is in North Vietnam, just on the border with China. And it actually is a very good... It's very close to Ha Long Bay. But we're quite close to James Bond Island here. That shot, that big aerial shot, helicopter shot, had a fishing boat in the middle of it. They had never been able to get a moment when there wasn't a boat in the shot. So CGI once more came to our rescue, and we removed the boat, put in the waves, and that became the shot. CGI, I haven't done a film before with so much CGI work and with so many facilities. We had CineSite doing most of our work, and they were really marvelous. They, in fact, lent us a CGI operator and machine, and we had it in the cutting room, so we could explore CGI shots, computer-generated shots, actually in the cutting room, input them into the Avid. We could animate storyboards, put them into cut sequences, animate rockets, ships, planes, alter shots, modify them, put them straight into the Avid, take them out again, and do this all long before we ever went to the CGI house and started discussing the final shots. It, in fact, made us able to deliver the film so quickly at the end, because all of the CGI shots had been tried out and created, in fact, within the cutting room at video level before they were handed over to the CGI house. So the
CGI, which creates the final shot, is creating it of a quality that will hold up on film, but you could create a kind of a temp version of that same shot
in
the cutting room on video, which is a more forgiving and easier medium to work in.
And in fact, we were even lower than video. We were using the lowest video level, I should say, because we were just going into an Avid. So it only had to be up to the level at which one views an Avid image. Later on, when we came to preview, we actually used all these Avid images, and we never went back to the original film. We didn't use film at all until the final release print. We previewed a full-size digital output on a very large screen. I think we were the first film to do that, or almost the first film to do that.
And that's so that the audience could see the temp versions of these special effects, so that they'd know what was going on.
We didn't have to preview with many shots having blue screens behind the actors, which often happens with CGI films, that when you're close to finishing, some of the shots are nowhere near being finished, and all you have is the blue screen shots or the green screen shots, where you literally see the actor in front of a blue screen, which will later become the final image. In our case, because we generated these in the cutting room, we had finished composite shots only at television level, and we could include them in the cut and then show them on high-definition television on a very big screen and have a complete film to show a preview audience just a week after the end of shooting. It then took another 8 weeks before these video images were put onto film and rendered at the appropriate film level and quality.
Missile lock on. Send a signal to the Admiralty. Task group under missile attack.
And now the third act of the film is well underway with one huge sequence in which Bond and his ally are invading the enemy castle, if you will.
That's right. They're storming the volcano. And in this case, the volcano is a moving ship, the stealth ship. So here again, we've combined model shots from Mexico, the Pinewood tank, shooting outside in a tank where we built the underneath of the stealth ship, generated waves and spray, and then the inside of the 007 set, where the stealth ship was built, the interior of the stealth ship was built. We're at the Pinewood tank here, the outside tank, shooting at night in August. Rather short nights. It was warm, but it was very short nights. The sun would come up at 4:15 or 4:30, we'd be close down. Very hard to generate waves, it turns out. And one spends a lot of the evening trying to get the waves right. And the camera, meanwhile, is on this huge crane that has to be very well earthed. And the actual shooting becomes much easier than the creation of the other mechanical effects, the waves and the spray and keeping everything wet. Now we're inside the ship. We're on the 007 stage. Once again, we're still back with video screens. We're back with a very high-tech world where we're lit with neon video screens, very large set.
Are you sure you want her up here?
Rather tricky to light. We spent a day, I think, figuring out how to light it. We lit it several times, mainly turning off lights until we could give it some definition. It was hard to make it look as big as it really was and have the right feel to it. And we experimented with the lighting.
It looks enormous. So you succeeded in that.
Yeah, Robert did, yes. He did an excellent job. But it was tricky to light, and in the end it was about removing lights and getting darker and darker and then picking out perspectives. Almost all the way through this scene, though, we're seeing a very large set, but we're shooting in very restricted areas. And each of the walkways is very narrow, and the bridge of the ship is actually quite small. So we are limited in where we can shoot. We were shooting on a crane, mainly, so we could get some sense of the ship moving.
The Spy Who Loved Me, an earlier Bond film, ended with an action sequence inside a supertanker in which they took the captured submarines. You must have had a concern to make this sequence look as different from that.
Absolutely. We ran it many times. We wondered if we were different enough. In fact, all the way through the Bond films, you're dodging previous Bond films. They've done so many big action sequences that you're constantly referring to other films and saying, is it different enough? We're back shooting inside a real British frigate here with actors and also the real seamen from British Navy. Very interesting that when you have 2, 3, 4, 5 actors on screen at the same time, the 2, 3, 5 format, which I used to think was really for vistas, for big landscapes, one quickly discovers that actually is much better for dialogue scenes. And it's really wonderful for over shoulders. It's great for close-ups. I guess if I had my druthers, I'd almost always shoot 2, 3, 5. It's such an elegant and interesting frame. And more powerful, I think, than 1.85. In France, of course, they think anything that isn't almost dead square is ridiculous and commercial. But I think 2.35 is very interesting, and particularly so for character scenes.
Now, everyone who's watching this is no doubt watching it on DVD in the letterbox format, but a lot of people are going to be watching this film in a pan and scan version or in a standard television format. Were you conscious of framing in a way that would protect that, or?
I don't think you can protect it. I think finally you have to go for the format that you've chosen to shoot in, and then spend a lot of time making it as good as possible in the other ones. And in fact, we spent two or three days making the transfer and reshaping for the regular TV version.
Yes.
And but I do think at the beginning you have to, when you're shooting the film, you have to commit to what you're doing, and in this case to 2-3-5, and explore and enjoy all of its advantages. And you can't possibly frame for two things at once. You can't really protect yourself without ruining the actual setup. So we kept them separate. We did the video version later and spent a lot of time on it.
When you Shoot to Kill with Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger, you also did that in the widescreen format, but with Super 35. Here you're using a different kind of lenses.
Super 35 is wonderful. It gives you the same frame shape, but it does it with spherical lenses, so you get the normal depth of field you would with a 1.85 frame and with those lenses. Anamorphic lenses have half the depth of field. They give you the 2.35 shape, but with much less depth of field unless you use far more light and make up for it. In this case, I thought it'd be interesting. It was the first time for me to use anamorphic lenses, have almost no depth of field, and to use backgrounds very deeply out of focus with close-ups, and to explore that. And I think it's very... I enjoyed it a lot. This is the end of Ricky Jay. When we came to this scene, Ricky asked me if he could have a dying speech, if he could extemporize something just before he got shot. He felt that his character hadn't been well enough used, and I think he was right about that. And he wanted just a moment in the sun for his character. I asked him what it would be, and he came up with something. And I said, well, I'll talk to Jonathan and tell him that you're going to give a little speech. And I did that, and we did the first take, and Ricky started to speak, and Jonathan shot him immediately. Ricky's face, he was devastated. He fell over, of course. I called cut. I went up to Jonathan. I said, you know, Ricky was going to give you a little speech there. He said, I know, and I heard the beginning of it. I didn't like it, so I shot him. I've just stayed in character.
That's great. Now, this set, this enormous interior set is on fire, and it will stay on fire until the end of the movie. This must have created an enormous safety problem.
We had fire engines outside and sometimes inside. We had about 6 weeks of fire where we would lay out places, areas to burn, set fire to them, bring in firemen, stop the fire, reset, reload. Every single take, I think, took 20 minutes to half an hour. Just to do one tiny thing again always took half an hour, often longer. It was complicated. The materials that were used and had to be used burnt very badly, so we had considerable smoke problems filling the set, and had to evacuate the set, pump out the smoke a couple of times.
As we cut to the Royal Navy ships, they're lit very orange, and of course in the stealth boat, back in Jonathan Pryce's world.
We were neon and blue light, very hard-edged, very techno. Absolutely, and we used that to separate geographically and visually the two areas so that you'd always know where you were in the British ships. And the mood, in fact, reflects the characters. So they're
warmer and
the good guys are warm and nice and cuddly and wonderful and they're bound to win, and the villains are cold and ugly.
Coming up is a big sequence in which Michelle Yeoh takes a leading role.
She goes into the turbine room, has a couple of guns, and takes on 8 or 10 people.
That's very unusual in a Bond film. We've seen this already, that she's done more than the Bond leading lady normally does.
I think it's time that that image of the Bond women changed, and she helped bring that about. It was time to have of somebody who was independent, as smart as Bond, as able as Bond, didn't need him and yet was teamed up with him. I think the earlier, the women in the early Bond films were very much modeled on the 60s idea of women's place in stories and maybe even in life. And this was an attempt to try and view women a little bit more as they are today. I remember mentioning this to Michelle and saying, "This means, Michelle, that we should try and give you two machine guns and not one. Do you think you can handle it?" She said, "No, Roger, those guns are as big as I am. I can't. One is difficult enough." And I asked her to try one gun for a while. She spent 5 minutes firing one machine gun, and I put the second gun in her other hand, and she said, "This is impossible." And Mama, she said, "No, no, it's not impossible. Matter of fact, I think maybe two guns are better than one." It took her 10 minutes to become addicted to the idea that every woman should have two machine guns. I remember when we were getting ready to shoot this part of the ending, we came to think, or I came to think, that we might not have enough action. And we added this scene with Pierce firing the rockets. Now, looking back at the film, I can't imagine why I thought there was any moment in the film that wasn't enough action, but we added this whole one-minute section with the rockets going off. I think Vic Armstrong came in and did some shooting at the weekend and added some extra shots. And we blew up a little bit more of the boat. Now, back in the turbine room, I think this is one of the few places where I was using slow motion. Ever since Peckinpah, I've been nervous about using it. I felt I'd watched Sam do the slow motion. But we tried it here, and actually my editors tried it on too in a couple of places, slowing down shots that we'd shot at normal speed. And it was very effective.
Were the shots that were slowed down, were some of them slowed down in the camera, or was it all
post-production? Some of them were shot. I think where she jumps off a platform in the turbine room, that was actually shot in slow motion. Some of the head turns here and earlier on were achieved in the cutting room and through CGI. That used not to be possible. It used to be that step printing really looked ugly. But these days you can...
Step printing is printing every...
frame two, three, four times.
Which would create a jerky motion.
Yes, it's a stylistic device that's much used in MTV, but not much used in films. But you can actually slow shots down now without the appearance of jerkiness using the computer.
In effect, the computer morphs from one shot
to
the...
Yeah, and blurs it, yes. This is one of the last big explosions. The set is really getting destroyed now. We were within 2 or 3 weeks of the end of shooting and having to shoot everything in order because, of course, we were destroying the set as we went. And even at this time, we hadn't quite worked out how we should bring about Carver's demise. We had various versions of it. And every day almost, we had a discussion about could we use the CVAC, could we kill him one way or another, should we blow up the whole ship? Would the CVAC really work? Could the CVAC actually be used safely?
The CVAC is that gigantic drill that we saw in the beginning.
At the beginning, it sinks the Devonshire, yes.
And that was in your mind and Bruce's mind from the start to try and use that if that could be achieved.
We had it. It's in the boat. It's ready and poised. We'd always planned that it would be the CVAC, but we came to think that so much of it would have to be off-screen. It would be such a gory incident that we would, in fact, have an unshowable climax that would be X-rated. I think about a week later, we'd explored all the alternatives. Perhaps only 2 weeks from the end of shooting, we decided that we would stay with the CVAC, and then we started to wrestle with the problem of how we could really use it. It was built out of aluminum with motors and so forth inside. The teeth were actually aluminum and quite sharp, and there was no way of softening them or making them safe to be anywhere near. So we decided we'd use a very large perspex shield between the actors and the CVAC itself, and we had one prepared and built, and we had to open up the set to bring it in. We brought it in and we put the lights up, spent 3 hours lighting, and realized that there was no way that we couldn't see we could avoid seeing the perspex.
The perspex is plexiglass.
Plexiglass, yeah. That would protect the actors from the machine in case the machine went a little too quick or got out of control and came towards them too fast, because they were going to be staging a fight only a few feet away from it. And the perspex was the safety factor. Whatever we did, wherever we moved the lights, you could always see the perspex. There was no way we could use it, so we had to abandon that. We then had to either abandon the sequence or shoot with the actors and these teeth in the same place with nothing in between them. I think it's a measure of Jonathan's confidence and Pierce's huge professionalism that Jonathan said, well, I can work with my back towards that machine, as we see right here. So long as Pierce has a hold of me, I know he'll pull me out of the way. And so we'd staged this fight. The machine got to within about a foot of them, and Pierce hauled him out of the way, and then we tried to pull Pierce out of the way, but actually he moved pretty fast. It was a very unpleasant 2 days of shooting. I think we were only 3 weeks before from the end of shooting when Bruce came up with the idea that we could sink Michelle into the water and then have the final fight between Gertz and Pierce, with her underwater and probably drowning. And I remember being concerned that the fight could only last 1 minute and might have to be too quick and not dramatically effective. But in fact, I think it works quite well. We staged several versions of the fight. I think even the Hong Kong team came and gave us some suggestions. It was very difficult to shoot on top of this missile launcher, because although it looks close to everything else, in fact, it's suspended out over this tank, and the camera is always on a crane. The actors have to be chained to it. It was quite a dangerous place to be, and the metal was very unforgiving. And as you can see, it's... there are very few shots with doubles in them. This was the actors doing the fighting.
Having Michelle underwater gives the scene tremendous tension.
It does. I was so concerned that it would limit the length of the fight, because we all know that nobody's going to last more than a minute or so underwater. But in fact, we found we could expand this to a minute 30, and the tension that it gives you more than makes up for the fact that you have to keep this fight very short. This is traditionally a very, very big last scene in a Bond film, where the physical villain goes after Bond. And in our case, it was quite a bit shorter than usual. But I think by having her underwater, it does give it the necessary tension. Again, we were cutting as we went on this. We shot this scene probably 5 days this fight took. And every day I'd go in and see the previous days cut together. I think this was one of those cases where Dominique told me that our storytelling wasn't quite clear, and we went back and shot extra inserts of the rocket being released so it squashes Otto's foot.
So we see that he's trapped and can't move, right?
That's right. It's a wonderful advantage that doesn't really happen so much on film, at least. It's a little bit slower on film. The Avid allows you to go and see film material cut so quickly. I think there are probably one or two editors who can cut as fast on film as on an Avid, but we have all got used to being able to see multiple versions of a film very quickly with an Avid technology. It doesn't make the overall editing process quicker, but it does mean you get to explore more choices. And when you're shooting something as complicated as this, you can see a version with sound effects and music very, very quickly and know if you're missing shots or whether you've got the storytelling clear and the drama is compelling and whether the performance is working.
And in a case like this, where you're shooting for such a long period and in many cases on the same set, you can go back and get the shots that...
Look at it again, yes. You can revisit things, add shots, do things slightly differently.
On a more normal scale, the kind of movie Under Fire, you don't very often have that luxury. Once you've done something, you've moved on.
Not one day, not one hour could we redo. We were in different places all the time. We were constantly moving, and you could never go back and shoot anything again. We're in the tank at Pinewood again. a scene that I think I felt wasn't really necessary. When we did the underwater kiss, it worked so well. I think I felt that we could just end the film there, but I remember Barbara and Michael felt very strongly that we always had, the Bond films always had that last scene on the surface, and I think they were right.
I think they were right too, but I'm glad that you did not that you used the wreckage rather than a raft. I'm sure you saw Austin Powers, and the original ending of Austin Powers was after the installation in Las Vegas blows up. You see Austin Powers and the leading lady in a yellow raft, and they say, well, how'd you get here? And Austin Powers says, because all my movies end this way. So it's great that the yellow raft is not appearing here.
Absolutely. I remember we all talked about Austin Powers. It was being made while we were making this, and we knew it was both going to be very funny and also probably getting us exactly right in places, and it was a source of a lot of amusement. Kirby Broccoli, he had a lot of vision to get these started and then to take such control of them that he could keep them going for all this time. It's probably the only family-owned film, and they've preserved it and nurtured it for 30 years now. It's run very much as a family business, and for a year or so you get to join that family and make one of their films, and it's been a fascinating year and a lot of fun.
A tough year, though, Roger. Would you do it again?
I don't know. It was a lot of fun the first time, maybe in a few years' time, but it was a fascinating challenge and a lot of fun.
Well, we all grew up with the Bond movies, and it's...
I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it.